Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 564. And it's a really good conversation. I think you're all going to enjoy this so much. This week and next week are two returning guests, and they both feel like classic episodes. But let's focus on this week's guest for now. I'm getting overexcited and ahead of myself. This week I'm talking to Sophie Hagen. Sophie came on, I think we figured out, 8 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago. And Sophie wasn't happy with their performance on the podcast. And we talk about that. I thought it was a great episode. It's a very popular one. But after this episode, I get it. Because I was just going off that one interaction that we'd had, and it was wonderful. But then we had this interaction, and it's even more wonderful. Sophie's an amazing Danish comedian. Go back to the first episode with Sophie if you want to hear kind of their journey into comedy, growing up in Denmark, and then them moving to the UK. It's a wonderful chat. But this one is based around their book they've got coming out, which is called Will I Ever Have Sex Again? And you can pre-order it now. And I think by the end of this, if you've not pre-ordered it by the end of this, I don't know what to tell you, because I think it's a fantastic subject and topic. I think Sophie is the perfect person to look into it. And we get into all of it. I was about to start rambling on about the book and about what it's about, but it's better to hear that from Sophie themselves. We're brought to you as ever by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's where you can get all my merch, support the podcast, support the record label, support yourselves by looking damn good in good clothes. We're actually doing a thing soon. When this comes out, it won't be up yet, but keep an eye on my socials and on... This is the first place I'm going to announce it properly, in fact. So, I was talking to some friends, and I've watched a few things about this on socials, and there's a massive rise in recent years in transphobic graffiti, homophobic graffiti, Islamophobic graffiti, anti-Semitic graffiti... All these different things. So we're putting together a sticker pack. We used to have sticker packs, Scroobius Pips sticker packs, often using our "We May Not Be For You And That's Fine" slogan. Here's how it happened, actually. We had those for sale for years. When I heard about this, I thought, right, I'm going to make those free, and all you have to do is pay the postage so that people can just carry them around with them. If you're out and about and you see something horrible, then you can put a sticker over it. And it's often not like big graffiti pieces. I say graffiti, it's often just scrawling, so you can cover it up in such a manner. And then I went on the web store and looked at how many sticker packs we had left, and we had none. So instead, I'm going to spend money on getting new sticker packs printed and made up and make them free, and all you'll have to do is pay the postage. Yeah, and the idea is you keep these in your bag or in your coat, or wherever you keep them. And then if you see something hateful, it could be any kind of hate. If you see something hateful, you whip a sticker out and you cover it up with something positive instead. So they're going to be coming soon. I don't know why this is kind of the sponsorship section of the podcast and I'm advertising something that's going to actively lose me money, but, you know, speechdevelopmentrecords.com is where they will be exclusively available. You can also go to patreon.com/ScroobiusPip. I've just changed some things over at Patreon. It's been really nice. It was off the back of the Ask Pip episode. No, it was the intro of the Dolan episode, I think, where I talked about the options, because it's always been $1 a month, but now I've added... I was talking about raising the price, because if there's no difference to the individual, really, between $1 a month and $2 a month, obviously that doubles the amount that we're getting, and it goes to pay people, you know, it's important. But instead, you guys suggested we add some extra tiers. So we've added a $3 tier and a $5 tier, so you can support in any way you want. The tiers are no different, simply because I don't believe in restricting people based on financial status. So I didn't want to add more benefits. I know it means that hardly anyone will go for the higher tiers, but I didn't want to add more benefits because I don't believe in financial exclusion. And I think you can also follow over there for free, and every post I do goes out to everyone, I think. So head over to patreon.com/ScroobiusPip, basically, and if you've got money, throw it in the pot. If you've not, just kick it, hang about. Another place that you can just hang out for free and throw money in the pot if you want to is twitch.tv/ScroobiusPip, yo. One of the reasons I'm a bit hoarse is as I'm recording this last night for one of my Thank Pippets Fridays streams, we did a Song Wars stream where I pick, it's on a website, I pick a topic, for example, songs to riot to, and kids' TV themes were the two topics. And then people in chat through the website can submit songs, and then we have a 32-song tournament pitting them against each other, and people in chat vote for which song they think should go through each round. And it was amazing, and it got me very hype and excited. There were some travesties from the idiots in chat in the kids' theme tune. There were some votes I did not agree with. But yeah, that's all going on at twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio, and it's free. It's a long intro, isn't it? I normally just ramble through these, but I want to tell you about this stuff. Let's stop the intro, though, because this is a hell of an episode. As said, I'm joined by Sophie Hagen. I adore Sophie Hagen. I was so pleased to have them back on and to see that they were the person tackling this particular subject, which is essentially involuntary celibacy. And a lot of you, your ears will prick up at the thought of incels and so on and so forth. But yeah, it's an amazing chat. So let's get into the chat, eh? This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 564, with Sophie Hagen. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Right, I'm here today with Sophie Hagen. How are you?
I'm good. I feel like it's spring. Yeah. I know it's not. It's 7 degrees, but
yeah,
I can see a sun sometimes. That makes me so happy.
But this is the spring I like, because it's presenting as hot, but it's not making me sweaty and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's nice enough to go, I feel springy, and yeah, you know, raises your mood, but I'm not kind of out there going, am I getting sunburned? Have I? Yeah. Am I going to sweat too much and just have a horrible time? So
yeah, you wake up and it's bright outside, which yeah, you just don't have for what, 6 months out of the year in this country. So
yeah,
I think that in itself makes you feel a lot better than
I've usual. Still got a coat in the bottom of my bag that's got a hood on it, because I'm still not comfortable enough for it. Definitely not to rain.
No, never take that out of your bag. Even in June, you're like, just in case. You never know.
All my podcast gear today and everything, and I'm like, no, the most important thing is, in case it rains, I can put my hood up over my headphones so I don't have to be left with my own thoughts.
Yeah.
So I don't want to have to have a day in London where I'm with my own thoughts all day. So
no.
The hood is purely for their protection. But we first chatted on this podcast 7 years ago.
Was it 7 years?
Yeah, it's quite mad, isn't it?
Whoa.
I didn't realise that
until I
looked at it. I was going to write like 4 or 5 years ago, but then I was like, well, the pandemic, which again warps all our minds. So every time I'm like, oh, it's 3 or 4 years ago. It's like, no, that was when we were in lockdown. It was before that.
Oh,
so
wow.
How much before that? But
wow, that's mad.
Was it 17 or 18? Or maybe I've calculated it wrong. It might have been 8 years ago.
No, that's wild.
I think it was 2017. But it was in a chat as we were just talking about that I completely adored, but you reached out a little while after to say you weren't happy with your, or how you came across or how you were on it. So let's start by giving 2017 Sophie a performance review. What was it? Again, because we're just discussing, I've had this on numerous podcasts, as we were saying.
Yeah.
The first time I was on Richard Herring, I thought I was so boring and had nothing interesting to say. I've had it on a few different ones. I've had other ones where I'm like, yes, that was, everyone please listen to this because it went well.
Yeah.
But what did you feel that didn't work, or do you even remember?
I don't remember what exactly happened, because I never re-listen to anything where I can hear my own voice.
Yep, I'm the same.
But I think the gist of it was that I had so much to say and so much we could have talked about. Mm. And I think we ended up covering like 1% of it. And I just talk. And I could talk about a singular little tiny topic for hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's over and you're like, oh my God, I didn't get to talk about anything else than this like tiny fragment.
Yeah.
And I think that was it with that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, I was just blur. I was just blaring at you.
I'm exactly the same. I can't remember who I was listening to. I think it might have been Jesse Armstrong on Buxton. And he was making notes as the conversation went along, as the guest. And he was like, I like to make sure I, like, if you're saying something, I don't want to interrupt, but if I've got something, I'll just make a little note. I was like, that's so good and so professional, because I'm the opposite of that. It will just be, as you say, I'll go off on a tangent, but he's been there and gone, right, let's note that. We'll come back to that and note that.
Oh, I love that.
It's amazing, right?
And that also just feels like a classic Jesse Armstrong thing to do. Just so on brand.
Could never be me.
So on brand.
Yeah, exactly.
Not for us, but...
So I wanted to have you back on since then, and... To be honest, it's been me that kind of has dropped the ball several times in lining this up. But I always get excited because these things seem to happen at the right time, because you have got a new book on the way, which I'm incredibly excited to talk about. As soon as I saw you post about it on Instagram, I was like, oh, wow, this sounds interesting. It's an eye-catching thing. It comes out on the 23rd of May, and we'll get into it. But I guess before that, like, how's the last 7 or 8 years been? I think we should catch up in some way along
there. Yeah, I know. I was thinking that. Because when I met you outside, I was like, how have you been? I was like, who can answer that?
Yeah.
Who can answer that?
Yeah, how can we catch up? And there's the weird thing of following people on socials, feeling like I'm catching up more. I remember the excitement I had when you got your dog and things like that. So there's loads of things that I feel like I'm up to date on, but not. Yeah.
Wow. I mean... What can you say other than ups and downs? I feel like what hasn't happened? I'm in a place.
I mean, we are going to talk a lot about what hasn't happened.
Well, what I haven't done is a bang. There's been no banging, that's for sure.
We'll get into that.
I don't know. I don't think everything has just gone up, up, and up. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's been a lot of obstacles, some of which I've handled with grace, some of which I've not. And I think I'm in a place right now where I'm sort of re-emerging from quite a long period of succumbing a bit to things that have been difficult.
Yeah.
And I think, weirdly, lockdown was really good for my mental health. Obviously it was horrible and terrible, but I've heard a lot of people who are sort of in my shoes of being not just introverted, but also having social anxiety and PTSD and all these other things, that having to be inside was like a weird relief. So I think I thrived on that a lot. And then coming back out into the world, which has been hard to have, you know, don't really have a choice in the matter, because when the world just opens up and decides to ignore COVID altogether, you can't be like, well, I'm going to stay at home, because then you suddenly can't pay your rent. But that has been, it was tricky going back out into the world after having felt the safe comfort of my own little flat with my own little dog. Well, he's not little, but my own dog.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it can be weird, kind of, because I think it can make you realise what you are and are not comfortable with. Because I had exactly the same. There's obviously that there was loads in the pandemic that was a struggle, but there was also loads that I would have expected to be a struggle that wasn't a struggle. And I've kind of had a realisation in the last year or so where I've basically been contemplating, typical male, contemplating whether or not I really need to have therapy. and I've, again, typical male, I've landed on not so far, but it's simply because I've realised that I've been really lucky with all my mental health issues and my particular, the way my brain works in that. So I am quite socially awkward. I'm not a big fan of, you know, crowded rooms, social situations, but I also don't get FOMO, so it works out nicely.
Yeah, same.
I'm not comfortable in social situations, but I don't really want to be in them. So it's not that big a problem, if you know what I mean. If I was someone who's like, yeah, but I really want to be there, but I can't, I'm like, I'll enjoy it for a bit and then I'll leave. I had a wedding a while back for a relative, and it was a big breakthrough for me, because the big party the night before, I had the best time, but my favourite moment was in the cab home. Yeah. And I've realised, and I've had that ever since then, I've really relished in having a lovely night out and then really enjoying leaving. The leaving bit is the bit that I love. And I've been like, well, that's okay. If that's my problem, then that's not too bad. I can live with that.
When I was a teenager / in my early 20s, I used to be like, I love parties. But then I realized, when I thought back to it, what I would do at house parties is I would go to the kitchen where the lights were on, the music wasn't on, and I would just tidy up and do the dishes. And then one by one, people would come into the kitchen when they needed a break from the loud partying and music. And then I would have a very lovely heart-to-heart with these people, and would you know, they would often, within 30 seconds, we'd talk about trauma and stuff like that. And then they would go back into the party and then the next person would come out. And that was, for me, that was like, let's have another house party.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't actually be part of the partying. I just love the little kitchen, like, oasis that I created.
I love that. It's beautiful. And I love people finding what they love and what they enjoy. And I think that's such a tough thing, particularly in the world of social media, but in social situations in general, because the easy example is people would be like, oh, it's your birthday. We need to go out. Mm. And I'm like, well, I don't like going out. So for my birthday, I'd rather we have a few friends. Like, I mean, all these, or New Year's Eve is the easy example. It's like, it's New Year's Eve. We've got to go out and get drunk and do this. It's like, I love New Year's Eve and I stay in on New Year's Eve. It doesn't mean I hate New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
It just means I've got to a point of acknowledging what I enjoy and doing that rather than, as I may have previously, partied on my birthday because it's the expectation of your friends.
Yeah.
Rather than what I actually want to do.
And what you think you should be doing, because that's what is, in quotes, normal.
Yeah.
So then you do it for a year, especially when you're younger. You do it all the time. And then you go, well, hang on. I've not enjoyed a single one of these experiences.
Yeah.
What am I doing?
It will lead on to the subject of your book, because I think I can only speak for myself. But in my youth, I thought I loved clubbing, but it was because I felt I needed to go out and get drunk and I wanted to try and have sex with someone, hopefully, maybe if they want to, if it's not too much of a problem. So when I kind of got a bit older and stopped drinking and stopped being so necessarily focused on going out and pulling as such, I realised I wasn't into clubs. Exactly as you say, I kind of would get there and be like, oh, I wasn't enjoying any of this. I just, particularly where I'm from in Essex, that's what you're meant to do at the weekend. You get drunk.
Yeah.
And you try and kiss someone,
yeah.
Which again can be great. It's a wonderful thing. But your book is called Will I Ever Have Sex Again?
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a really big subject. I think you're probably sick of people saying things like this, but I think it's a really brave subject to just be so open about and go into, because you've not had sex in, I think in the book it had one number, but in the press release it was 3,000 days or so.
It was a really tricky one to go with the days thing, because that does tend to change every single day.
Yeah, and
it's almost 8 years at this point.
And you screw up the whole promotion if you go and have sex with someone.
Yeah.
It's kind of a problem. Yeah. It's kind of something that you actively want to do, but it's like, well, the whole point of this is, I'm talking about this. But so I guess just looking at that as a number, what was it about talking to me for an hour in a dark basement that killed your libido and sex life? And because it feels like we can almost trace it back to when we sat down and recorded this podcast last. But what is it that made you want to talk about this and tackle this as a subject, I guess?
Well, it came from needing to read the book. Whenever I have an issue, I love self-help books. I love anything that is, and I don't think self-help books is just a one tiny genre. I think any book that you can read that helps you in any way is a self-help book.
Yeah.
So I went looking, so I got out of a sort of messy, I don't know, abusive seems like a big word, but I guess it was abusive, situationship, affair, just a messy, messy thing that had lasted around five to six years, where we hadn't had sex. And then caveats, what is sex? Does sexting count? Big question there. But I came out of that feeling very sort of, like I hadn't been properly touched at that point for, was that then 6 years or 7 years? And I wanted to read a book about it. And every single book I found that was about sex was these very seemingly confident, sexy, beautiful women talking about like how to transform your sex life. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I need to form my sex life. There is no sex life to transform.
Yeah.
And everywhere I looked, everyone was having sex. And they were just talking about how to do that in different ways. And I'm not, you know, shitting on that. That is very important and great and good for them. But I needed to read something from someone who was in my shoes, someone who was socially awkward, fat, neurodivergent, non-binary, queer, but a virgin in the queer spaces. And just someone who'd been in this like messy situation and someone who had to get back into it after a long time. And I couldn't find anything. I couldn't find anything about it. So I was like, okay, well, maybe I write that.
Yeah.
And I started working on it and we started pitching it. And it kind of took 2 years for me to properly, I think I'd written like a seventh of the book. And then I got a book deal last May and then finished it in 6 months.
Mm.
So it came from needing it myself.
Yeah.
Needing a book to for that very particular situation. And the thing is, I thought I was alone. I felt very silly about it. So even when I got the book deal, I was like, yeah, but I kind of felt like I tricked them. I was like, oh, well, good luck selling this book because who on earth can relate to this? Mm. And then in the beginning of September last year, I thought, I want to include a few stories from other people. So I was like, okay, I put out a thing on Instagram saying, can anyone relate? Can anyone relate to feeling like there's an obstacle between them and sex? And you want to have sex, but you can't quite get there and something's in the way. Mm. And I thought I'd get 30, maybe 30 people at best. And I made this Google form. And within 24 hours, I'd gotten 1,800
wow.
messages and stories from people. Wow. So I had to shut it down because there's too many stories now.
Yeah.
And that was when I thought, oh, okay. Oh, this is a thing. I'm not alone with this. There were just all these people with so many different reasons that I hadn't even thought about could be reasons. Mm. And I thought, oh, okay, this is a thing. Like, there's quite a lot of us who, and people are not talking about it. I'm not hearing people talk about it. When I say I haven't had sex for almost 8 years, people gasp and like, oh, how could you live?
Or there's a bit in the introduction or in the author's note maybe where you say about talking to a friend about it and them going, oh, I've not had sex in 2 months. And you're kind of going, yeah, same, but it's many 2 months, but
so like, many like two
added
months.
Up. But is that, yeah, I think it's fascinating. I think the really fascinating thing you touched on there is the not talking about it. Because I think as society moves forward, we have loads of things that progress and things are easily left behind. I'm not going to turn this into about that, but one of the things I see a lot of, because I work with STAMA, who are the British Stammering Association, is seeing how disability representation has gone through the roof in so many areas for so many disabilities, but not for stammers at all. And their big campaign was there's no diversity without disfluency, and it's trying to readdress that. But I think we're at an amazing time for sex positivity and sex openness. And I would shout out podcasts like Come Curious and Sex with Charlie and Nina and loads of really amazing frank and open podcasts, which aren't salacious, are sexy in places, but aren't there to be like, ugh, hear this crazy story of ours. It's to talk really openly and honestly and not simply be, look at how sexy this thing that happened was. But again, even there, just generally, if someone wants to talk to you about sex, you're going to talk about the best sex you've had or the crazy sex situation you had. You're rarely going to talk about the period that you weren't having sex or haven't had sex in. So it is this really weird left behind part of this kind of continued sexual revolution, I guess. And you're touching upon a lot of those things in the book, I understand. Again, I've not read the full book, we were saying beforehand, I try not to read any of it because I think it's better to hear from you, but I couldn't resist a bit last night and on the way here this morning. But how do you feel about that, where we are? Because there has been a big kind of, as I said, a sex positive, huge change and movement, but yeah, how do you feel the success of that is and where we are with that, I guess, and how it affects where you've got in this scenario?
Well, I think it's overall great. Like, overall great. Like, I love it, especially since writing the book. I've been, you know, I follow a lot of these people now, and there's definitely a place for these conversations. And I'm so, because so much of it feels very female-led, which I love. Like, I love that women get to talk about sex and get to be sexy without being slut-shamed and all of these things. It's just not the space I've looked for or the space I've needed. And I think, I just don't see a lot of awkward sex, you know? Yeah, I don't see a lot of people who are weird talking about sex. And, like, that's the kind of stuff I love. Because often it's very beautiful women. And I'm just like, of course you have sex. I'd have sex if I looked like you.
Of course it's wonderful.
Which is, I'm sure a lot of them would say, well, fuck you. Like, I have my own struggles and they would be right to do so. But I'm kind of, for me, when I was reading through those like 1,800 messages from people, a lot of people hadn't even begun to question it. They'd just gone, wait, now that I think about it, I haven't had sex for 5 years. And then as they were writing, they were trying to figure out why. And a lot of them wrote like, oh, I mean, they were like, I'm going to post this, but I don't know if I need to anymore because now I've actually figured out what it is. So they hadn't even had the space to think about why, because we're not really talking about it. And I feel like there possibly was a time, a brief moment in time, like at the very, very beginning of like when people started talking about incels, before incels became, you know, bad murdery men.
Yeah.
But that was that. That's a movement was started by a woman who was like, I feel awkward. I've never had sex. I'm involuntarily celibate. And then immediately it was taken over by toxic men's rights activist-y type. But there was a moment there where that could have been a thing where, you know, she tried to create a little movement where people who come together and say, oh, I don't know how to do this and I'm feeling a bit weird about this. And it's kind of that, but trying to, you know, this time it's a very pink book. Yeah. We're trying to not reach those guys.
Yeah. I mean, it's why I was so excited to see you tackling this. Not excited that you've not had sex for 3,000 days.
Well, someone has to be.
I'm sorry to hear this, but excited to see you approach it because just looking through kind of the contents, you're looking at sexuality and sex positivity. You're looking at sex education. You're looking at trauma. You're looking at the changes in gender and what can come with that in the changes in sexuality. Like, I've been having a lot of thoughts about that recently because I've always described myself as boringly straight. But, you know, I've had a real thing recently where I've realised I'm just not into willies. So I'm not into penises. But I've had friends who are trans males that I'm incredibly attracted to. And I don't know if that's just some age-old thing of, even though I'm so trans positive, it's still, well, technically it was when they were born, you know, some stupid thing there. But I find that stuff fascinating because I'm like, well, what does that mean for my sexuality? Because these things are constantly changing. But I like that you're going to be looking into all of the things, whereas, as you mentioned, incels, they solved it really quickly.
Yeah.
Just went, well, it's women, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's women's fault. So they're the enemies. Whereas you don't seem to be going, it's anyone's fault. Not even your fault. You're kind of going...
It's going... It's just asking why. Happening? It's asking why. And I think it's another reason I think it worked out really well that it's me writing this book, because it wasn't like I was having a bunch of good sex and then a thing happened and now it's no longer happening. Because that would have been a different book. There would have been a book about this one thing and then my journey. Instead, it has been all the topics I cover is because they have had something to do with why I haven't had sex or why I haven't had good sex in the past. So it is my own, you know, my gender has changed. Well, my gender, I don't know if it's changed, but I've become aware of my gender and being non-binary in the past 8 years. I've gained a lot of weight in the past 8 years. So my body image has changed and shifted a bit. My sexuality, I've become more, I think I'm more attracted to women or people who are not cis men now than I was before. So, and there's been a lot of sexual trauma, but also my definition of a lot of what I used to think were good sexual experiences have also changed because I've looked at them in a different light.
Yeah.
So it's all of these things, plus this like weird relationship I was in, being neurodivergent, realizing that the sort of, I thought I had this progressive, cool, amazing sex education because I'm from Denmark and we're really cool and progressive. Turns out, no, not at all. Of course not. So it's an accumulation of all of these things that have led me to be in this situation.
Yeah.
Which is why I like to cover it, because there's also like a lot of things I'm not covering. So a lot of people in the stories talked about how being a parent could had stopped them from having sex for a myriad of reasons. And I was like, I can't cover that. Like, I'm not the person to talk about that. I'm not.
Yeah. Of course.
So there's loads of stuff that just hasn't been covered, but I've covered the things that really matter to me.
But it's the fact that you're being clear at the start of who you are and where you're coming from with this. Like, again, like this isn't asexuality. It's not that you don't want to have sex or aren't drawn to that. I like that quite early on. You're very, again, I love your writing, but you know I'm a fan of you as a person and a comedian anyway. But I love your writing because you'll be massively open, but then you'll make it funny and light so it isn't overwhelming or panicky. But quite early on, you talk about your openness sexually and that you're into a lot of different things. And it's not that it's just, I'm a prude and therefore I haven't had sex in this amount of time. It's like, no, you're very open to things, but it just hasn't landed there. And I think that kind of thing's important. So I also liked what you said there of reevaluating past experiences, because again, I think that can be one of the most important things as we develop as humans. And I also think it's one of the biggest problems that we have in society at the time, because often men can't do that. And it's why there's such a panic over the realization of consent, of sexual agency, of all these different things. Because men of my age and older panic. Because for sure, when I was at college and school, we'd go out and we'd get drunk and hope to meet drunk girls. So we're all drunk and we can hopefully sleep together. That was perfectly normal. Now you look at that and go, oh, that's a bit shady. Yeah. And how drunk were you? And if they were drunk and you weren't drunk, then how's consent work in that situation? Things like that are really important conversations to have and reanalyze. But I think it makes a lot of men go, well, I'm not a rapist, so you're all overreacting. And it's just having fun. It's college. It's this and that. But another thing you tackle really early on in the book is you say that these are your memories and your perspective and people's perspectives on sexual. I mean, I've raved about it last year, but the film How to Have Sex, I think, is an amazing kind of study on perception in these situations, because people can have completely views and it's not as black and white. So I guess, how have you found that part of it, of looking back for the book and just in your own analysis as such, looking back on past experiences and maybe reevaluating things that you thought were a happy memory or that you thought were a bad memory or you thought, you know.
So in the book, I also interview different people who are experts, which has been really, they're some of my favourite bits of the book, as these are what other people have said. But one of these people, I think it was Miranda Kane, who is a former sex worker and a comedian and runs a club night for fat people, which is really cool. At one point I said to her, like, oh, I had sex with this guy and I have two memories of it. And one is, oh my God, it was totally wild. Like, I just went home with this guy and then we just like totally fucked. And then we like never spoke again. Like, oh my God, it was so hot. I was so wild and crazy.
Yeah.
And then the other memory is, I don't think I wanted to do it. I don't actually think I was into it. I think I did it because I thought, well, what if no one ever asked me again? What if this is my only chance?
Yeah.
And I ignored all the red flags. And I was like, I just can't. Like, it's so hard to figure out like which one is, like they both feel real. And she said, well, maybe they were both real. Maybe you can have both realities, that part of you did feel excited about this. Like maybe there was aspects of the sex you did enjoy. And then also you did it even though you probably didn't want to. And that can also be true. And I think holding those truths at the same time has been really valuable, because I think so much of sex is we want it to be black and white and want it to be straightforward. You know, when we do think about sexual assault, we want to think about it as a bad man in hiding in bushes, jumping out and attacking.
Yeah.
But most of the time, it's happening between partners, between people who are friends or both consent in the beginning. There's so many what I probably shouldn't call gray areas. But like, what I mean is just we're all humans, and a lot of it happens in situations where we're not clear on what is actually happening. And oftentimes, one of the things I was really curious about writing about was what, and it was really interesting when I was reading people's stories, where people would give this different names, and some people would call it self-rape, and some people would call it politeness rape, which is where at no point do you tell them you don't want to do it, but you know you don't want to do it, and you do it anyway. So the stories were always like, I didn't want to make him feel bad. But if you'd asked, it was always women with men in this situation, if you'd asked the guy, he would only remember that as a positive experience where she was super into it and said yes multiple times and went through with it. And if they found out that she didn't want to do it, they would probably be, hopefully, would be horrified. But the women would go home and go, fuck, I probably shouldn't have done that against myself, which is such a, I didn't even know, because I think that's been most of the sex I've had has been against myself, my own wishes. But there was no way for the person I was having sex with to know that.
Mm.
And that was something I found really, really interesting. And I spoke to a sexual trauma therapist who talked about how, like, it doesn't really matter to the body, like, who does the attacking.
Yeah.
And if you're doing that to yourself, like, that's also bad. That also feels bad in your body.
Yeah, of course.
And I think it's definitely one of the reasons that my body has now gone, well, then no. Like, no. Because it's not like I haven't had offers the past 8 years. But when the reason I started looking into this was because when I got near the option, like, if I swiped on a dating app and someone
that's one of the things I was going to say. You bring up that there are points where you've matched with someone and then you've
deleted
the app in a panic. It's not as simple as I've just not met anyone. It's like, no, there's more to analyze and break down there.
Yeah, because I get really anxious. And it makes sense that I get anxious because my body is like, well, we don't trust that when you don't want to do something that you're then going to say no. So we're just going to pull back and make sure we make you feel really anxious because this is now, like if I get into a situation, in an intimate situation with another person and my body knows that I wouldn't say no if I didn't want to do something, then that's now a dangerous situation to my nervous system and to my body. Yeah. So my body is stopping it before it can even happen.
Yeah.
So before I can enter into a intimate sexual relation with anyone, I need to know and learn that I can say no and I need to be able to do that. And I also need to make sure that the other person can respect that.
Yeah.
So it has to feel safe. And I think if there's one word for the whole book that I didn't expect would come out of it, it's safety. It all comes down to safety. You have to feel safe with the person you're with. And that is such a weirdly, that has just never been taught to us.
Yeah.
Like when we learn about sex ed, no one says like, oh, safety is the most important thing. You have to feel safe with the other person.
Yeah.
That's not what we learn. We learn like, you know, oh, if their penis is hard, yeah, then you have sex with it.
Yeah. There it is. It's there. I think this is so fascinating. I bang on about this all the time. But one of the great things lost in our current kind of era of the social media era or the us versus them type era, tribalism era, is nuance. And again, I think it's fascinating because obviously in no way are we saying there's not the horrible rapists, because there definitely is, that are doing things against people and all that. But it's those grey areas that are fascinating and should be discussed as well, with a comfort of discussing it. I know I've definitely had a situation in the past where I slept with someone that I didn't want to sleep with, and I felt I made it clear. And we ended up discussing it afterwards, and we felt fucking like I was almost scared to bring it up because I knew that they were a good person, that they weren't an abuser or anything like this. It was just things hadn't been read, or you know, in the moment. And we discussed it, and it was heartbreaking because it was. But again, it'd be different if it was someone who was a bad person, who was a villain, who was a rapist or whatever else. But it was this situation where I'd expressed it a bit, and then I'd stopped expressing it, and it's like, well, that happens as well. That happens where you don't want to, and then you do. So there's no way of the other person knowing this. You know, these things can be confusing. And again, it was, the thing there was knowing that this isn't a bad person. It's not as black and white as it can be in these situations. So,
and also taking it forward and going, okay, so then how do we do this next time?
Yeah.
Like, what then what? Because what I ended up with after writing the book was this feeling of, okay, well, next time I end up in a situation that can become sexual, it will have to be with someone who is equally knowledgeable about consent, but also someone who wants to know how I'm feeling about everything. Mm. Like, curiosity was such another big word for me. It was just, why wouldn't you be curious? You're about to have sex with someone. Why wouldn't you be endlessly curious about how they're feeling, what they want, what they like? How are you feeling now? What about now? Like, do you like this? Do you like this? Like, why is that? There's still a part of me that goes, oh, well, I don't want to be a downer. I don't want to be a party pooper. Like, is that sexy? But yes, of course it's sexy.
And that's one of the things I was going to ask you is, do you feel, this is going to sound really weird, but do you feel living in England for a long time has affected you? Because I think there is a different approach to sex and sexuality and repression. And I completely agree. I've talked about this before. I think my favourite thing about sex is learning what someone likes and what turns them on and what they enjoy. I think it's the biggest bit of ignorance to think, I'm good in bed. It's like, you were good in bed with that person.
Yeah, maybe.
But the next person might, you might not have been. But the next person might want completely different things and might be react to completely different things. And that's the excitement and the buzz of it. My favourite thing in those situations is, as creepy as it sounds, observing and kind of trying to take in and take note of what works and what doesn't work and all these things. That should be the excitement. But particularly from a male perspective, there's a macho element of, I've got to fuck good. I've got to go in and be the man and do this and do that. And it's like, that's not helping anything. But I also think it's quite a British thing because, you know, we don't talk about sex as much. It is all kind of quiet. So what do you feel, I guess, the pros and cons are of growing up in Denmark, in which you've acknowledged there that you maybe thought was so wonderful, but maybe wasn't, and then being over here where there's other things that are maybe good and bad?
Yeah, I think a part of what you need to understand about Denmark is like our level of comfortable around nudity is, I only realized this, I was doing a photo shoot in Denmark recently And I was doing it with an American person and a Danish photographer. And I was changing my clothes between the two shoots. And then the American person was also changing her clothes. And she said to the photographer, she said, "Oh, do you mind if I change my clothes?" And then me and the photographer looked at each other and we kind of laughed. And I said, "It's so weird when people do, I don't know why people do that." And she was like, "Oh no, that's everyone who's not Danish would ask before getting naked in front of someone."
I used to have a Swedish tour manager and it blew his mind. He's like, if I got to 16 and, or at 16, I'd basically seen all of my friends naked, because the end of the night would be, we'd come back and have a sauna or have a hot tub or whatever else and just all be comfortably naked. And it wasn't sexual. It wasn't weird.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so British. Then I'm like, I've not seen any of my mates' penises. It's like, why haven't you seen any of your mates? Why are you being weird about it? What's the problem here?
You put on any just classic Danish film. Within the first 5 minutes, you'll see flaccid penises dangling.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so normal. The first penis I saw was Nikolaj Coster-Waldau, who's in, he's in Game of Thrones now, a Danish actor. And it was just his flaccid penis, because I wanted to watch a horror film, and he was just naked in the first scene.
Yeah.
And it was just, it's just such a normal thing. And it's interesting, because in the book I interview a flirtologist, she's great, Jean Smith.
Yes.
She's great.
This is a bit I'm excited to get to, because I think the joy and pleasure of flirtation is a very undiscussed and untalked about.
Oh, you need
to
read her book, Flirtology. Yeah. It is, I mean, there's so much of it that just doesn't apply to me. And I wanted her to be really annoying. And I wanted to hate her a bit, but she was just amazing. And I learned so much from her. But she studied flirtology all over the world. And I said to her, I was trying to be really like, and I said, "Oh, so now you're teaching British people to flirt?" I was like, "Oh, good luck with that." And she said, "Oh, Danish people were the hardest people to flirt with."
And I was really? Like,
and I think that's one of the things is in Denmark, it's so much easier for me to flirt because you say to someone, "Oh, hi, hey, you're hot. We should like hook up." And they'll go, "Yeah, oh, no." And it's just fine.
Yeah.
We're here. If I just said to someone, "Hey, you're really hot. Do you want to hook up?" Oh,
excuse me.
Like you just. So I feel like I don't.
Yeah, that's
speak.
Interesting because there's no need for the art of flirtation in that set because you can be so direct. Flirtation in a way is a building up to that. Is a
or someone like corrects the way your teacup is standing, and then someone is like, "Oh my god, he totally wanted to fuck." You're like, "What?" Like I just don't. I feel like I don't speak the language of the Brits. And so that's one of the things that would be easier if I was still living in Denmark, I think. But
I love it.
That's not to say that I haven't also had a lot of my worst experiences in Denmark when it comes to sex. But there has also been, they have also in many ways been quite liberating because we just do say the things, you know. Like I've sat at the end of a night with comedian friends of mine in Denmark and just been like, so one of them have been like, "Yeah, so who goes home with who?" We're just like, "Can I go home with you then?" And they're like, "Yeah, yeah, then I'll go home with her." "Okay, cool. See you later." Like, it's just been a kind of fun, nice thing. That still doesn't mean I was, you know, present in my body and I like super wanted it.
Yeah.
But at least getting to that point was so easy and nice.
Yeah. It's fascinating. It's fascinating what gets prioritized in different cultures and what is direct. Again, the title or the statement of not having had sex in 3,000 days really puts all the importance and weight on sex, which then makes it harder to overcome. But again, you could have had some really good flirtation in that time, or you could have had some really good moments and interactions and things like that that then change that statement.
Well, there's at one point when there was a bunch of my publishers and my agents, there was a bunch of people involved with the book, and I was in this email thread and they were all talking about it, and then someone had, and I think it was because they were British and they were uncomfortable with the word sex, but they changed the word sex to intimacy. So they said, "Oh yeah, so Sophie, who hasn't experienced intimacy for 3,000 days and I just felt this like, and I was like, "Oh,
you've got this wrong.
That is such a different word."
Yeah,
that is such a different, that's such a different, looking at it as that, I had to go, "Oh well, hang on, have I not experienced intimacy?" And a lot of this has been diving into what do these words mean? Because one of the things I had to realize was there was a, in quote, sexual encounter in the last 8 years. And I had to figure out, why do I not consider that sex? Is it something as simple as, well, there wasn't penis and vagina action? is it because if I thought of that as sex, then that would have been the last time I had sex and not this other time, which was actually good? And a lot of this, I mean, the question of what is sex, like, no one can answer, which is so annoying. Because I asked Justin Hancock, who's a sex educator, and I really thought, because he's a sex educator, he would have the answer. And instead, he gave some really annoying philosophical, like, oh, well, what is it to you? And I was like, no, I need you to tell me exactly what it is.
But it is that, isn't it? Because it is the what is it to you? Because, like, again, it's mad that there's, like, there's oral sex. It's got sex in the name.
Yeah,
but then there's sex. That's not sex. Yeah. It's like, it's literally got sex in the title, but oral sex isn't sex. And then, and that must have been an interesting thing, as said, in this period to have had breakthroughs or revelations in your sexuality. And again, you touch upon early on in the book the kind of concept and categorization of virginity, because you imply that you've only had sex with cis men, therefore your virginity as a lesbian or as bi or whatever is more confusing and is still there. So how does stuff like that play into things? Because again, I want to reiterate, I think it's so good that we're in a period where there's so many revelations on what gender not only does mean but can mean, on what relationships can mean and can be, all sorts of variations, and so much of it just boggles my mind and I don't understand it, but I think it's amazing that it's all happening. But no one really talks about that. With that can come a whole load of confusion.
Well,
if you're thinking, maybe I'm in that world, but I don't really know because I've not done this and I think I like that, but...
Well, I think the thing that makes this really... The thinking and the exploration of this is what's important. Mm. If you get too focused on a goal of finding the answer, you're basically fucked because there's no right answer to any of these things. Yeah. And that's a lot of what I did with the book, was I was trying to find the answers. And everyone I spoke to, all the research I did, people ended up being like, well, what about this new question?
Yeah.
And I'd be like so frustrated because I was like, I wanted a script.
Questions.
I wanted a rule book. I wanted like top 10 things I needed to do and everything would be fine. And really what it taught me was that no one knows. You can make a lot of this up for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to, like, if it feels like you're a virgin in a certain way, then sure, you can be a virgin.
That's what I think is really good. And again, I get this education through podcasts more than anything, but I instantly came to mind was the Come Curious podcast and Florence, one of the hosts on there, kind of realizing they are queer and part of the queer community, but feeling like a fraud because they've never had any queer experiences at that point, and kind of wrestling with this. And again, I think that kind of stuff being spoken about and spoken about publicly, because most of, exactly as you were saying about a lot of the sex podcasts, it's a beautiful woman, it's a lot of the LGBTQ podcasts will be really people who really know their identity and really are so, can talk so focused and honestly and boldly. And for a lot of people, it's far more of a blur and a mess.
Yeah.
That it's like, oh, I love hearing that, but I don't know if that's me or if that's part of that is me. And
The way I describe it is, I feel like I'm even to go back to our clubbing, our arrangement with clubbing, I feel like I'm standing in between two clubs.
Yeah,
and one, it's a club I know super well. It's Sex with Men with Penises.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's a classic.
I frequented it. Like, they know my drink order. I've been in every corner of that pub. Like, I go in, people go, Sophie. I'm like, yay, hi, everyone. I know it so well. And I'm not interested in being in there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then there's the other club, which is sex with people who are not men. And I've never been in there. Like, I've maybe tried to peek through the windows. I don't know if, is there anyone in there I know?
I've heard, like, loads of rumors
about
it.
Do I know
it?
The bouncer? Am I on the guest list? Like, is there a wardrobe? I don't know. And I really want to go in, but like, I don't know if I, where's the door? And I'm just, and it's just so scary. And really, all I want to do is go home and just like hang out with my dog and watch Netflix.
Yeah.
Like, that's the feeling I have right now, sexuality wise, where I'm like, I really need, a butch queer person to come and take my hand and take me into the club and buy me a drink and sit me down in a corner, take me to the kitchen of the pub, and then I can hang out there.
I love that we recorded this in Shoreditch, and your description of that mystery club is every club in Shoreditch that it is. You can't even find the door. You've heard rumors about it. You don't know what the rules are. It's like, oh no, that's just a club here. It's fascinating. I always remember talking to a friend of mine about them realizing that they were gay and saying how strange it was, because when they were realising that, there were clubs to go to. But it's very much you go there to have sex. And it's like, he was saying, as a straight man, like, what was your first sexual experience? I was like, well, it was a girl that I was kind of friends with and we knew each other, and then it developed into this and developed into that. He's like, I would have loved that, but there wasn't anywhere to have that. It was just go here, do you want to have sex with this other man? And he's like, I'm still figuring out what I want. So the pressure of that being, here's the option, rather than... And again, I think it is changing now, because I think people are, there's far more openly queer events and kinds of scenes. But particularly at that point, I was like, yeah, that's heartbreaking. I would have been terrified to just go to a club and have sex with a stranger as my first sexual experience.
And from what I understand, that stems from a time where it was illegal and dangerous. Mm-hmm. So the intimacy and the sort of let's sit down and have a drink and get to know each other just wasn't allowed in the gay, at least male community. Mm-hmm. It was meeting up in parks, don't look at each other's faces, yeah, because if you recognize them, that could be dangerous to both of you. Like, and I, one of the people who I've included there, his story in the book, was someone who told me that there's a big scene within for like gay men where they're sort of, I guess he did describe it as kink, was just seeing men hold hands, like walk down the street and hold hands and like walk their dogs. It's like the most simple, tiny little symbol of, I don't know, like the kind of intimacy you'd see straight people have all the time anywhere. But because it's so rare, we don't get to see that side of it.
It's so weird. I was literally talking about this to a friend last night, because I had a period in my kind of formative years where we'd go to a lot of gay clubs because I had gay friends. And it was a point where I'd start to get annoyed, because I was like, well, as I've touched upon, I want to go out and try and have sex as well, and I can't here. I said, this is annoying. So the first time my gay friends all came to a straight place, the penny dropped, because suddenly they weren't holding hands anymore and they weren't able to be themselves. And it was that realisation that, oh, right, in your world, I may not be able to pull as easily, because again, there'll still be straight people at gay, you know, I might not be able to pull as easy, but at least I can be me. In my world, you can't be you. You've got to pretend to be someone else. And that scrapped that instinct. I was like, right, if we're going out, we're going to your places. Because it was that realisation of that, of the boundary there, which you don't realise until you're confronted with it. I've had on this podcast, I've had someone I consider a dear friend, Tom Robinson. Not Tommy Robinson, that's the bad one. Tom Robinson and Michael Cashmore, who I absolutely adore. And both of them, speaking to them, sat in front of me, not reading about them in a textbook or a history book, and finding that when they realised their sexuality, it was illegal. Not it was taboo or it was uncomfortable or it was hard to tell my parents. It was illegal. And this is a real living person. This isn't, as I said, this isn't a thing in a textbook. This was within their lifetime. And stuff like that just makes you realise why, again, this is such a simple rant now, but why all these people go, why do we need gay pride and things like that? It's because there's still people alive who were literally committing a crime with their emotions.
Have you ever interviewed Juno Rush?
No.
So I interviewed them for my book, and they were, I think they're 60 now, and they're a trans person. But when they were young, they were presenting, living as a queer man who then had HIV. And they were talking about this, like, how they weren't allowed to go to uni because of their AIDS status. And how there was something so wild about talking to a 60-year-old trans person and getting all of their wisdom. And like every single sentence they said, I was just like maniacally like writing down. I was like, everything needs to go in the book. This whole conversation needs to go in the book. Because everything they said was so... You were just talking to someone who had reached a conclusion that I don't think any of us will... None of us will have lived that life that would lead us to having to figure all of that stuff out.
Yeah.
In order to reach that point,
yeah,
in their lives. Like, it was my favorite interview of the book. It was,
yeah, that sounds amazing.
Wild. Yeah.
So how has your gender kind of journey, do you think, how's that affected your sexual desire or your sexual confidence?
I'm leaning, so like I used to, you know, wear dresses and I had like long hair, and I was quite femme in my gender representation. Mm-hmm. And within the last year, I've cut my hair off and I'm, you know, stopped wearing dresses a couple of, maybe like 5 years ago. Then I went, I made the switch from dresses to jumpsuits, and now I'm in trousers.
Yeah.
You know, the gateway the gateway piece of clothing is jumpsuits.
Yeah.
And then dungarees and then trousers. So I'm now presenting a lot more mask, or at least androgynous. And it feels very, kind of feels scary. Mm. It feels scary because I feel like I've dressed to go into that club that I don't know if I can get into yet.
Yeah.
And now I've dressed in a way that I can't go back into that other club. And I know it's not as simple.
Right, yeah,
it's all in my head. I know that. And if it was anyone else, it'd be like, you're silly. You know, gender's a construct. But as soon as it's yourself, you're like, oh. And I realized I was non-binary. Oh, I think it was 2018, 2019. I think it was like a New Year's Eve, I remember, after I'd heard Travis Alabanza do an interview on BBC. And I knew Travis already. And I think the wheels had been spinning in my head a bit. But then I heard them say something quite simple about being non-binary. And I just went, oh, that's it. Oh, that's the feeling. That's why I've been saying woman. Like every time I've called myself a woman, I felt like I've done it with like quotes around it. Like, you know, I'm a, you know, woman. Like it's always felt a bit like, you know, like as if I was saying woman, but not really. You know what
yeah,
I mean?
Like yeah,
it,
yeah, yeah.
After every time I said it. And it just felt quite liberating. And also at that point, I was in this situationship, relationship, whatever that was, which is described in the book in a lot more detail. And he saw himself as mainly straight. And when I told him I'm non-binary, he didn't really care. So like my main romantic sexual person at the time didn't really ask any questions, would still sometimes refer to me as a woman. When other people referred to me as a woman, even though they knew he wouldn't correct them or anything. And it became this, what should have been like I'm now entering into this space of I'm comfortable and, you know, proud of my gender, became a bit of this is in the way of this person's attraction to me or his interest in me.
Mm.
And I think it's not a coincidence that I didn't cut my hair until after I was out of that relationship.
Yeah.
So now I feel like I'm more myself. But the myself that I am is uncertain of where I stand in terms of dating. And, you know, like my dream is I want to live in a DIY house, a house that needs to be built from scratch up with a lovely butch woman and or a butch queer person. And I don't know how to get there without having to do the dating stuff and the swiping on apps and getting over my initial panic.
Yeah.
But that's my dream right now, is to just live in this genderless, wonderful house where we can just exist.
Yeah, it's a beautiful dream. And again, it is fascinating because it is always a journey, right? It is always, it's not as simple as this. You until you're let into the club, you've got to kind of fake it until you make it. You've got to try and be as much like what you perceive to be inside the club as you can. And then when you're in there, that might change. You might go, oh, actually, that part wasn't me. That was me trying to, that was my interpretation of what I'm meant to be. Actually, here's what I am. And all those things are so, it's such an interesting journey. But I think it's the thing that really excites me about this is when I talk to my goddaughters about any of it, because for
how old are they?
They're like 12 and 14. Ooh. Probably got that wrong. Could be 10 and 13, around that. But again, for even our generation, it's huge decisions, it's a big deal, it's a big reprogramming, it's a big change. And it already feels like their generation, it's not that big a deal.
It's, you know, great,
it's so casual. My goddaughter recently, I went to her school play and she was playing a boy, but the boy that she was playing was a cross-dressing queer lad. And it was like, this is mind-blowing that this is in your school and this is the coolest thing. And it wasn't a big deal. I didn't know any of that going in. She'd not mentioned it to me. She's like, oh, I'm playing Billy Elliot's best mate. So I'm like, all right, cool. You know, we'll see what this is. And just things like that would just, it filled me with positivity that we're sitting there thinking, oh, we're going to have to educate them on this and that and that and that. And it's to them, it's not a thing. It's like, why are you letting me know about the fluidity of gender? I've got loads of mates who are just such a varied representation of gender. It's like, that's obvious. It's like, all right, yeah. It's only because we grew up with such rigid restrictions and boundaries that it's a big thing. I went to see Monkey Man recently, the new Dev Patel film, and it got, I instantly looked online because I saw an interview with him talking about trans representation in it, and there was loads of people in the comments saying, oh, they had to wokeify this and this and that, and it's the modern world. And the trans representation in it is the third gender that India has had for over 4,000 years. It's not some new trans thing. He's doing this historical thing. He's telling this story and he's just representing honestly. Yet to a certain area of people are going, well, this is all just the modern wokeness. It's like, no, this is history. I spoke to Stephen Fry about this and him giving each other examples of different historical cultures and times when there was at least three genders. So the myth that this is a new thing is, the new thing is going men and women and that's it.
Mm. But it's also, we're a society built on those gender roles.
Yeah.
And if you take them away from people, even like me, I still boggle with it. Like I often talk to a lot of my non-binary friends and like how often we misgender ourselves because we're so used to the language. And we go, as a woman, like it's so ingrained in us. And if you take gender roles away from people, that means that men have to start doing the dishes.
Yeah.
And so they will fight that
forever. I was going to say, the roles are interesting. It's the gender part that's boring and useless. Like, again, it was a big realization to me that everyone speaks about how in ancient Greece, like homosexuality was perfectly normal. It's like, no, it just didn't exist. There was basically masculine and feminine, and that was it. It didn't matter what gender you were. They were just dominant and submissive and things like that. It's like the roles are absolutely fine. It's the fact that we've attached them to such random things, which do work a lot. Like around across a lot of society, that they do work. And now you can argue if that's because how we've been brought up and because of the system we're in, but they don't work completely. So it's so stupid to grab onto them so rigidly.
And it's really freeing.
Yeah.
Like what it actually, when I, Juno in the book, in the gender chapter as well, was just talking about the freedom of transness and the just letting go of all of that, because it's all restrictive.
Yeah.
Like transness is good for everyone, including the people who are not trans, because it liberates us from all these ideas, all these pressures, all these expectations. And what if you just got to be? What if all you had to do was just exist as whoever you were?
Yeah.
You look the way you are. You have the name you want. Like you're spoken to the way you want to be spoken to. How are you fighting this? How is that something you would, why would you fight this? What are you trying to hold on to? Yeah. Some little, like the power that you don't even have, because the only people who have the power are the people with the money. Like it's just fake. It's all fake.
And it's all fake because it's all set up as well. We're told it's a hot button subject. So it's a hot button subject. Like I was talking to my mum about this recently because she was saying about an event she's going to, and last year it caused a few problems because you had to, on the form when you arrive, you had to put your name and your pronouns, and there was a lot of people who were perfectly fine with everything but didn't want to put their pronouns. And you can explain that putting the pronouns means that everyone's equal in this situation rather than the people who got an unusual pronouns or whatever else. But you can, right, and again that argue, well, my trans friend who's going doesn't mind if we get it wrong. They'll just correct and it's okay after that. But equally, I wanted to say to my mum, you wouldn't mind really if someone mistook you for a man. You'd laugh and go, that's weird, but you'd rather not. So it's the same there. And the solution I came up with, I was like, rather than remove the preferred pronouns question, add more questions, a preferred hot drink, a preferred pizza topping, all these different things. And then if you've got an issue with that one, it's because you're being a dick. It's not because you're like, but if you literally just had your name and what's your preferred hot drink, no one would say, well, I don't know why I have to tell you my preferred hot drink.
It's wild.
You know, it's like, it's because it's because we've been told it's a really intrusive question when it's not. It's just another thing.
Well, the way people feel about pronouns who are not affected by it themselves.
Aren't affected at all.
It's wild. Like, and people, and I get it when, because I use all pronouns, but people assume that non-binary people all use they, them, and that's just not the case. So I'll have people who go like, oh yeah, and she, and they, you'd think that they'd kicked a dog off a balcony. Like they react as if it's, and it, you have to go like, no, hey, it's okay. And then suddenly it's on your shoulders to calm down this person who feels like the worst person in the world. And you just have to go, we're all okay with this. You can just let it go. Like it's okay.
Yeah.
It's so, like all those people who are like, well, I don't use pronouns. It's like, no, then you just don't know what it means then.
You literally do. And again, it's the simple thing, like at events, if you have your name tag and there's pronouns on there, it's like, it just makes things easier. It's the same as if you didn't, like you could not have a name tag, but then, and you'd be okay with telling people your name every time, but it's easier not to. And the same as you could have the pronouns not on there. and you just have to tell people each time, but it's easier not to. If you can just have it there and it's not anyway.
It's just kind. It doesn't cost anything to just have a little bit of kindness. But I think a lot of people just think it's such a panicky thing for so many people, and they really feel challenged, and they feel like we're taking something away from them. And it's just a, it's, and it's going back to just what they have been taught.
Yeah.
That gives them value. Yeah. You know, it's the same, like in a kind of parallel world, it's the same with thin people or people who are really into fitness and fat people.
Yeah.
Like they have learned that value is in being thin. Yeah. Their value is in being, in quotes, healthy, in being, going to the gym. Like that is such an identity thing, and it is in their heads the morally correct thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's what makes them good people. And then they see a fat person who's like drinking a Coke, being like, I don't give a shit about being thin. And it makes them furious.
Yeah.
Even though it has nothing to do with them.
Absolutely.
They feel like, well, if you're saying that this doesn't give me value, then I have less value. So you're taking value away from me. And it's ridiculous.
But their arguments always hold no, or don't hold up to any scrutiny. So again, not, I don't want to piss everyone off, but before we started, we were talking about Joe Rogan, who, you know, I think has said many bad and questionable things over the years. But I always had an argument for him, because he would at times argue, or he'd have people on the podcast at least that would argue, if I'm telling a fat person to lose weight, it's for their own good, because it's not good for their health. It's this, it's that. Now, Joe, and as I did at the time, I was really into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which Joe's really into. I don't know anyone who has trained Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for a length of time who hasn't got neck problems, joint problems, all sorts of different problems. So can I say to them, you shouldn't do that because it's not actually good for your health. I know you really enjoy it and I know it's got its benefits, but it's not good for your health. So you shouldn't do that. It's like, it's exactly the same as telling someone, well, you shouldn't eat that because it's not good for you. It's like, it's fuck all to do with you.
But also the stress that being shamed and being discriminated against and having strangers come up to you in the street and telling you that something is wrong with you. Stress is one of the most unhealthy things you can experience as a person. And so by going up to someone and shaming them and making them feel bad, you are making them more unhealthy than they were before they met you. So you don't care about their health.
No,
like if you really wanted health for them, you would maybe vote for a party that went, that you'd vote for a political party that cared about lessening inequality, because the most, I can't remember the words for this, the thing that makes people the most unhealthy is inequality. But that's not really what they mean. They just mean they don't want to look at fat people.
They
just can't be honest about it. And it's like, well, just fucking say it.
That's exactly it. It's just fucking say it. People don't like having to face the reason they're saying something, because it's normally they know that it doesn't make them a good person.
And also,
and they're good excuses. I've got a good reason to. It's like, no, you're being horrible.
And they also, it's so personal, because if they had any compassion for fat people in their lives, they would have to have compassion for the part of them that is, I mean, oftentimes they're former fat people, they're the worst. Or they're like, in their heads, they're like, if I get fat, then I'm the worst person ever. So I have to hate fat people so I don't get fat. They have this idea that if they started thinking that fat people were okay, they would then get fat themselves. And like, it's so, like, babe, we can see you just hate yourself. Like, just try getting therapy instead of, like, drinking protein shakes.
Well,
like,
I mean, we do need to wrap things up. But before we do, I want to quickly ask, as we're on the subject, we've talked about the sex positivity movement and the pros and cons kind of thing. How do you feel about the body positivity boom that kind of started maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and has its ups and downs? Because it's also happened in a social media age. So again, there's tons of backlash. I think on all of these things, I mean, we talked about it with relationships and sexuality, but logic and emotion don't come hand in hand. So you can logically say, I'm very body positive, and you can have days where you're like, I'm a worthless piece of shit. I hate it. Like, well, it's not easy to maintain.
You're talking about two different, there's two different kind of aspects of movements, right? So there's a body positivity movement, which in general is more about you should love your body, right? It's more individualistic. It's more about you and me. Then there's fat liberation, which is the one I've always been attached to, which has been going since the 1960s. Started in the US with like an underground fat movement. And that was about equality and making sure fat people weren't discriminated against, had access to healthcare, that there were laws around discrimination, mm-hmm. that you couldn't get fired for being fat, those kinds of things. And that is a different thing. They don't care about if you love your body or not. Great if you do, but that's not the point.
Right.
It's about being treated as equals.
Yeah.
And I think that was sort of doing its own thing, and it's still doing well. There were some laws changed recently by a group in New York that made it illegal to fire people for being fat in New York, which is a huge accomplishment and super cool. Yeah. And also something no one talks about because people don't care. And I think that's all happening kind of on the sidelines of people are doing the work and they're doing really good work within this. And that sort of hasn't changed. But then there's the sort of big boom, which was body positivity, mm-hmm. which is essentially the reason it became such a big thing is because it was run by capitalism. So that everyone could say, love your body. And you know how you love your body? With this lotion, or with this thing. Yeah, or like, you have to buy all these things so you can love your body in the right way. And it became an influencing thing. Of like, massively. Get ready with me. And I'm part of that. By the way, I'm part of this wave. I'm criticizing it from the inside. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, wear this thing and then you look amazing. You can be beautiful and fat, that kind of thing. Which is also fine. I think it's a positive thing. But we really need to remember that you cannot love your body into equality. Like, it doesn't matter how much I love my body.
Yeah.
I will still not be able to expect to be treated in the same way as a thin person would at the doctors.
Yeah.
Like, we've, in the last year, we lost three different fat activists who had a variation of illnesses that they just didn't check because they kept sending them home and saying, you just need to lose weight. And then it turns out it had nothing to do with their weight. Mm. So that still continuously happens.
Yeah.
And that is what we need to focus on. We need to focus on, you know, fat people don't get paid as much as thin people, don't get hired as much. It's harder to find, 90% of landlords wouldn't rent to a fat person? There are so many, fucked up statistics around how fat people are treated. And that matters way more than do we love our curves.
Yeah.
But then, of course, Ozempic has happened. And that has just, it has brought everything back. Because now the only conversation that's being had is, well, we found a miracle drug that can cure fatness. So now, phew, we don't even need to think about your rights or your feelings. Because you can just take the pill that costs £200 a month for the rest of your life, which, by the way, might give you a lot of illnesses and also hasn't been proven to work after more than 2 years. But hey,
we've cured you. Yeah.
So right now, that's where we're at. We're at this like Ozempic, kind of a bit of a backfall into, oh God, how far back do we have to go before we can start fighting again?
Yeah, it's all fascinating. And it's one of the reasons I love following you on socials or hearing on other podcasts and just getting to have conversations with you is to be kind of educated on this stuff. And phrases like you can't love your body into equality is just sums it up perfectly. It's like, actually, it should be, again, it's that outlook. And I've had it with work with Stammer and the British Stammering Association before, that it's trying to get through to people that it's not about fixing us. Because fixing us would imply we're broken and we're not. We're just different and thus discriminated against because of that difference. So that's nothing to do with, can we get rid of it though? It's like, maybe. But how about all of this other stuff that's restricting it? And the amount of companies that won't allow you to contact them any other way than the phone, which you may not be comfortable on or enjoy. And if you email, it takes 3 weeks for them to get back to you. And all these different things that are restrictions rather. But again, the thing will be, but we've had this breakthrough in how we can mend you. So I don't want to be mended. Just maybe treated appropriately. Yeah.
Just let me book an extra plane seat on your website instead of having to call someone, please.
Yeah.
It's a very tiny ask.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I appreciate you taking the time. It's been a pleasure as ever. It's a disgrace it's taken us so long.
We'll see you in another 8 years or so.
Yeah, perfect. Will I Ever Have Sex Again comes out on May 23rd, and you're doing your book and stand-up tour in June and July. So what's kind of the balance there? Is it going to be readings? Is it going to be stand-up?
It's an hour of stand-up and then a break, and then 45 minutes or so of Q&A, where it's based on my last book tour. It'll probably mostly be me telling a bunch of secrets I'm not allowed to say.
Yeah.
The bits that weren't allowed to be.
I mean,
I'm never planning on doing that. I try to do the right thing. But the
big question I had is, now we've exchanged numbers again, can I text you each time you mention a comedian or things like that and find out who it is that we're talking about here? Because there's already been a few that I'm looking at going, I want to know who that is. I need to know if I know that person.
I cannot tell you that. And I am not nodding right now. Legally, I cannot say anything at all.
Of course. Well, thank you for taking the time. It's been an absolute pleasure. And as I said, I highly recommend people get the book and come out to one of the other shows, or many of the shows. The beauty of the shows that have Q&As after, I think, is you get a different show each time.
Yeah.
And are kind of things that warrant multiple viewings and things like that.
And people get to ask all the questions and I might tell them the truth.
yeah, exactly.
And then afterwards I'll do like a big signing and stuff and people can bring their books and I'll sign the books and all of that. It'll be like a full night.
Perfect.
Really, really fun thing.
And where can people find you on socials?
Instagram, TikTok, I mean, all of them, even Threads.
Love it.
Sophie Hagen, Sophie Hagen.
Yes.
Can I also tell them, because I know your audience is brilliant, can I tell them about my new podcast as well?
Yes, do, of course. Yeah, we're not even touched upon that.
No, I mean, it's called Help Hole, mm-hmm. and it's with me and a comedian called Abby Wamba. I still can't say her surname. I should be able to say that by now. an American comedian, and we talk about self-help books. So we take turns reading a self-help book, and then we tell each other about it. And we just both love it. Just all the good bits from all the self-help books. It's already changing my life quite a bit.
I think you're right, because there's so many out there, but I think the review system on books is useless, because you'll generally find people who think everything's the best book ever.
Yeah.
So there's so many out there and some will be crap. Like I found it I moved into acting around 8 years ago. So we met up and had a conversation. I quit music and went into acting. You stopped having sex. And I don't know what happened in that basement, but it's been impactful. But yeah, I found that with acting books was I'd read so many and there'd be so much that I'm like, nope, I don't agree with that. I don't like that. But there'd always be one bit that I'm like, that's changed my life.
Yeah.
So I love the idea of having a team on it.
And also,
so you take one each.
Literally.
And then you'd be like, ignore all of that bit, but this bit was good.
And Abby's reading all the books I would never touch.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just not interested in any of it. So having to be forced to listen to that is really good for me. And likewise, I'm forcing her to listen to one she would never read.
And
so
what's it called again? Help Hole.
Help Hole.
Help Hole.
Help Hole. It's our jingle.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a bloody pleasure.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk again,
as
I said, hopefully in less than 8 years. But
yeah, you'll text me every time you get to a person in the book.
Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. What an amazing conversation. What an amazing human. Get their book. Get their book. Pre-order it now. Pre-order it now. Will I Ever Have Sex Again? By Sophie Hagen. Fantastic conversation. I love that we get to have conversations like that. I say it a lot, but even if this podcast wasn't going out, I'd feel so lucky to get to have these conversations. I genuinely feel the person who benefits from this podcast the most is me, or from these conversations the most is me. And then the fact that I have so many of you lot who listen week in, week out and speak of the impact of some of these conversations and the guests I have is a bonus, a massive bonus. But I'm lucky to get to sit down with these legends, these solid gold legends. Yeah, I'll be back next week with another classic. Next week's episode, you know, I try and keep them around the hour mark these days. Next week's episode ended up being almost 2 hours long because we were just, every time I tried to wrap it up, we went down another beautiful path of thought. So yeah, you're going to enjoy that one. And it's a Hollywood star. Yeah, until then, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.